Jesus Christ was born on Christmas Day, and man will live forevermore because of Christmas Day.
Hi everyone, it's Nick here, broadcasting live from the Film Interrupted year-end wrap party. It's quite a do. Jack's over there on the Wheels of Steel, Martin busting a move on the dance floor. Seems to be doing some sort of combination of the robot and twerking. Really is quite remarkable, and I would encourage you, if you ever do bump into Martin, to ask him for a demonstration. Me? I'm feeling a wee bit sentimental. It's been a great year. I thought I'd take this opportunity to cast a glance backwards at the year that was. So thank you for joining me as we look back on the best of Film Interrupted Year One.
Before we get into this week's selection, how's your week been? How have you been doing, guys?
I've been doing very well. Been busy. We've moved into a new house. First house.
How does that feel? You feel like a big boy now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it definitely... I feel like a different person. You know that way you feel like when you get to a birthday and you think, I feel absolutely no different than I did last year?
Yeah.
I actually feel as if it's, you know, altered my standing. I walk a little bit taller now than I used to. I feel like a more useful and productive member of society.
A property-owning man.
Exactly, yeah. It's been good. I mean, it feels very bare at the moment. Like, I think about our living room and it's just like magnolia walls and two wicker chairs pointed at a television and a room without curtains or windows.
Wait, your house doesn't have windows?
Oh, no, not windows. Curtains or blinds.
Okay, like, that's so much better. It's like, I didn't know.
It certainly has windows. Yeah, they don't allow you to... It's not like... We're talking about Stalker later, but you know, it's a ball hair away from that, but it's not quite.
Hopefully it's not like full of like, you know, radioactive waste.
No, there is like, there was a massive campaign in the area. Like, it's built just off of a little village called, I don't want to give my address away, it's built just off of another little village, and it's built on like the site of a munitions factory. So there's rumours being spread by people who didn't want the development to take place that the ground was somehow soiled by, you know, years of dumping hazardous materials, and that we're all going to end up an absolute state if we live there. I'll take my chance. It's perfectly safe.
Very brave of you. Is this the first time you've been out of the house in general, though, isn't it? The first time you moved away from your parents' home?
Yes, it certainly is.
Straight into a bought home. That's like very 1950s.
Yeah, we... apart from the fact that we're unmarried.
Well, yeah.
We're sort of living in sin at the moment.
There's no sort of, you are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we're just sinners through and through. It's a massive change. We were saving up for a long time, and it just, you know, it was one of those things that we could have rented, and we were just concerned that we'd end up, you know, spending all our money with nothing to show for it. So we thought we had the opportunity to live with our parents and put some money aside, we did, and managed to get something that we're both really fond of. It would feel more comfortable, you know, if there were a few more luxuries in the house. And we don't have a dining room table either. It feels very much like a shell that we've just sort of occupied. Like, we're sort of squatting in it. Like, we're not supposed to be there. But it'll get grand.
Come. I mean, I think I said to you before, if you put word out you're in a new home, in my experience, what tends to happen is like, oh, you are? I was thinking about getting a new couch or a new dining room table anyway, so you can just have this. And my first, like, four or five flats, for different reasons, I got things like that every time I got freebies like that. So I wouldn't invest too much. Things will come to you. Think people will be charitable.
Yeah, I'll tell my mum you moved into a new place. She's always got furniture that, you know.
Well, that's where we got the wicker chair from. We would be sharing a wicker chair if it wasn't for the generosity of friends. But I know it's good. I mean, I'm noticing, like, I mean, I knew I wasn't handy. Like, that's not a surprise to me that I'm going into this place and I don't know my arse from my elbow when it comes to even, you know, even the very basics. Like, but that, like I say, it doesn't bother me, like, that I don't know what a Jubilee clip is and my dad has to do the plumbing, you know, because why would I? I don't have any reason to have that information to hand.
Mm-hmm.
What does bother me quite a bit is, like, whenever my logical intelligence is questioned, like, particularly with flat pack furniture, because I'm terrible at it and Emma is so good at it, like, so she knows, you know, exactly what pieces go where and how to assemble it, and I can't even hammer a nail. Like, I'm trying and the nails are getting bent and I'm going, what is wrong? And so much so that when Emma then takes over the hammering to do the hammering at her side, what I'm hoping is that she irreparably damages this thing that I've just spent a lot of money on. Like, that would be my dream come true in this moment. So I can tell it's really not a particularly healthy way to be thinking. It happens a few things. It happens with flat pack furniture. It also happened because my mate actually volunteered, like, guy I work with, that I'm good pals with, said, you know, if you need any help with flat packs, just come sit, call on me. I'll be down there in a heartbeat. I'll build all this stuff. And I was like, I just can't handle that. Like, I couldn't handle another man. It's bad enough Emma doing it, but see, like, another guy, like, a more deserving man coming into my house and building my flat pack furniture. Actually, it happened, weirdly, it happens with flat pack furniture. It also happens the time before the last time we were in London. And I knew it would happen, and I'd warned Emma that it would happen, but I knew that her and my pal who I was there with would be able to work out exactly where we were going on the tube just through a few seconds of, you know, plotting distances and how this line would be quicker than this line. And I knew that it would drive me mad, but it still did. Like, when they consulted each other without consulting me, I went ballistic. It was the most, like, embarrassing, like, thing that's ever happened. And it's like, as I say, normally I don't feel my masculinity being challenged, but in those situations it's just unbearable and I just become the worst person to be around. So it's been a trying time for Emma, and she's a good sport for putting up with it this long.
Well, I mean, at least, I mean, you've got a new build, so it's like, it's clean, you know.
Yeah, it's clean.
I mean, we moved into this place and it was nasty. It was like, you know, cheap rental before. And the first night I slept in this flat, we shared, like, a disgusting mattress that we covered up with, like, a bit of carpet we found in the cupboard.
Wow.
And, like, slept with, like, my big coat on it, you know? Because wow. We didn't want to walk all the way up the road to Lauren's place, you know? We were just like, oh, yeah, so this is it, yeah. Right, and we just ended up, you know, sleeping in a room, like, no curtains, carpet on, like, someone's mattress.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it could be worse, you know.
How about you, Martin? What's going on?
We're all right. We're getting, you know, settled into having, you know, our flat turned from a one bed with a kitchen and a living room into, you know, a two bed with a kitchen, living room, dining combo wonder room. So yeah, we're getting sorted.
I saw on the skate fed, it looked really nice.
It's pretty spectacular. Yeah, it looks really good.
It's worked out well. I've got an ongoing vendetta against the guy who installed our boiler, so we've had him reported and investigated, and he's now, like, under the cosh from the gas safe register to, you know, fix what he's done, or he's, like, you know, basically, whatever the terminology is, he's, like, disbarred from being, like, a gas fitter. So
is that your own satisfaction, or are you looking for anything else?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty persistent about this. I mean, he wasn't getting away with it.
But, like, is your reward the fact that he's now in trouble, or are you actually, do you stand to gain anything, like, monetarily from it?
No, they don't have you know, powers to oversee financial transactions, right, and recourse for refunds and that kind of stuff. But basically his livelihood is now, like, you know, seriously under pressure.
Yeah.
And All he had to do was phone us and say, sorry, I can't make it today. Can I come back on Tuesday? But instead, he just ignored it and ignored it and ignored it. And we've got a boiler that's pissing water everywhere. And it's like, you've got to come and fix this. We're not going to just let it go. So, yeah, don't hire Kiel Plumbing and Heating. They're crap.
We're so cautious not to mention brand names on air, but it was just Vendetta to the point.
Yeah, no, the guy's name was Scott Henshelwood. He's from Clydebank. Yeah, he's a fanny.
I still have a split opinion about him. I mean, everything I watched, half the films I watched, I liked. Those that I didn't like, I still quite enjoyed Connie's performance. I watched Highlander 2, and Martin was saying Highlander was a bad film. Highlander 2 is an atrocious film. I mean, really, really bad. I saw in Letterboxd you didn't actually pan it as heavily as me, but wow, that's no. Such a bad movie.
Highlander 2 was the one I grew up with. Highlander 2 was my Highlander. And there's a lot of things I do like about it. When the film started off, I was prepared to like it a lot more than I ended up liking it by the end. Connery is not the worst thing about that film. Connery is probably the best thing about
Connery's
the film.
Connery's the best thing about that film, yeah. This is a spiel of, like, okay, because once again I talk about this so much, this is my spiel about Sean Connery and Highlander and just how ridiculous that movie is. You have a movie set in the Scottish Highlands and you cast as a Scotsman a Frenchman with a really thick French accent, and then you cast Sean Connery, the world's most famous Scotsman, in the role of an ancient Egyptian trained as a samurai in Japan, currently posing as a Spaniard in Scotland. And just the absurdity of that casting is, they just want, I want to be in the room, they're thinking, we're making a film, it's going to be in Scotland, we have to have Sean Connery in it. What do we have? It's like, well, we have this Egyptian guy. Sold. Sean Connery can do it.
But Sean Connery can do it, and that's the surprising thing, is that film, he works in that film.
He does.
I mean, if you're taking it to this kind of, you know, absurd lengths where, you know, he is, you know, an immortal character who can, you know, experience several lifetimes, well, as long as you know, ignore the accent that he picked up, then fair enough, there's a bit of plausibility in it. But
I have no problem with that.
The intro is fantastic, where he just, like, you know, flies in on a white horse. Like, I can't remember his name, but, you know, it's like, hello, I'm Pedro Sanchez de Villalobos. And I'm like, get to fuck.
Yeah.
It was the most pure bit of enjoyment I had in the whole film was just, you know, seeing how happy he was, just like, yeah, I'm an Egyptian Spaniard, dude, yeah. Well, this is fun.
Well, you know, compare that to Lambert, who is possibly the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. He has no personality at all. He is, and I've never seen a male actor give a performance that's almost entirely about his hair. It's like, it's the most crazy thing. Even when he's an old man, it's a hair performance, and it's unbearable. The most surprising thing about Highlander 2 is that Michael Ironside completely misjudges his role as well, and he's completely out there, and it's not even fun when he's on screen. No. But Sean Connery is delightful in Highlander 2. He's the only thing that keeps me going through most of that film. Because the film itself is very out there. It's really not grounded in the slightest. It's, I don't know, have you seen Highlander 2?
I haven't got around to watching that one.
It's set, like, in the future. It's one of these 90s eco-apocalypse movies, right, where, you know, they've scorched the sky and it's been replaced by some sort of creepy
shield.
Sky. Yeah. Shield, yeah, I guess.
Okay.
Well, it's the worst piece of retcon you'll ever see in a sequel. It's like, no, we're not immortals. We're actually aliens from another planet. And we've met before, but we just didn't mention that in the first film. So,
well, yeah, and that's what I mean. The film is really bizarre. And it really doesn't need the characters to be any more bizarre than that premise, because already you don't have any reason to become invested in this world. It's completely, I mean, alien's the right word for it, and it's not even alien in an interesting way. It's alien in a too cool for school kind of way, where people go about on hoverboards and it's pretty terrible.
Do they actually have hoverboards?
Yeah.
Yes, there's hoverboards.
Fuck.
Michael Ironside pitches his performance to not even 11, he's at like 25, Lambert gives no performance. He's just abysmal. He's
the gigantic, like, you know, warrior from, like, you know, Kyrgyzstan or whatever it is, still in it.
I can't recall who you mean.
The one from the first Highlander, the Kyrgyz, the 7 foot, you know, warrior from the Caucasus that, you know, keeps, you know, chopping people's heads off.
He's replaced, I think, by a tag team of obnoxious Timon and Pumbaa style sidekicks to the main villain, who stick their tongue out till it touches their chin and then wiggle their head and go.
It seems like, and you can stop me if I'm wrong, but you weren't really knowledgeable about much Japanese animation in general.
I would stop you because you are wrong.
Okay.
I am certainly knowledgeable about a certain type of Japanese animation, like growing up.
Hentai doesn't count, but, you know.
I would rather not be as familiar with that as I think I am. I certainly know more about it than I would care to.
Well, what are you familiar with then? What is it you're familiar with?
Like, when I was a kid, like maybe 12, that sort of age, it was more like just the manga stuff, you know? Like, some of my pals were into it, so you go around their house and you'd watch. I'm trying to think of some examples, like Guyver or Crying Freeman or Devil Man, I think it was called, or my one pal actually had one called Urotsusuki Doji.
Yes, that's a really nasty one.
I didn't want to talk about it.
So, yeah, I was watching that, and I wouldn't say necessarily that I was watching them for particularly wholesome reasons when I was 12. I don't judge myself as a 12-year-old, but I was...
I'm shocked that you aren't a wholesome 12-year-old boy enjoying tentacle rape porn.
I can't remember that specifically in it. You kind of take what you can get at 12, you know, at a free internet era. So I was watching things with, like, you know, monsters and blood and limbs being lopped off and cartoon boobs and whatever. Like, this was how a group of 12-year-old boys amused themselves and, you know, whatever. But I feel the same way like I did about comics, where I feel like to a certain extent I kind of kidded myself on that I liked it more than I actually did. And it was only when I started to, you know, to really think about, you know, the things that I dislike about it, that I just sort of veered away from it and just, you know, I never went back to it. So I do have aesthetic issues with what, you know, the Japanese seem to favour in these types of cartoons.
I turn off maybe 80% of the anime I'm watching within 10 minutes when something like that happens. But once again, I'm somewhere in the West watching it, so it's been exported for a Westerner. But we're watching one on one thing that Netflix doesn't pick up on for me. It does very, very well at generally predicting what I'll like, unless it's anime. Because I rate Miyazaki highly, it seems I like all anime for whatever reason. And I started to watch a zombie one, and in the first 10 minutes, I had, like, in a high school, a boy and a girl running to the top of a building, you know, closing doors, hacking zombies, whatever they can find. And the girl falls, stands up, and it's got this really slow close-up of her arse that she sort of picks out her underwear from her ass crack, fixes herself, and then runs away. And at that point, I just turned it off, like, no, I'm not interested in watching this. It's just this really weird, creepy sexualization, which is throughout Japanese culture, that they think it's really appropriate or acceptable just to drop into things. That's a huge put-off for me. Or if there's ever a scene where there's, once again, huge exposition, then I just lose interest really quickly. Or if there's ever, like, you know, a mech suit too soon, then it's like, okay, well, this is just going to be that whole movie.
Yeah, there's a particularly unnerving strain of it that seems to be youth-focused, like, in terms of pornography. And obviously, when you're 12, you don't have to concern yourself with that necessarily. But as you get older, it becomes really disconcerting when you see, like, the way that they draw characters and the kind of embodiments of youth that they represent. And then they come to be defiled, and it becomes a little bit, you know, Well, a little bit. It becomes maximally disconcerting.
Yeah, it does. I'll agree with that. But I don't know. I'm constantly convincing myself that there's enough in, you know, anime as a whole. And I don't even think, you know, of course there's this entire art form. There's going to be something I like in it. But
yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, on record as saying I would never, like, you know, watch anime and dismissing it, you know, as an entire, like, you know, form or genre. But just of what I have been exposed to, there's only been one film that I've loved, and the rest have been pretty unsatisfying.
Yeah, I mean, you're a way bigger fan of Akira than I am, but I'll concede that the more I see Akira, the better I like it. I mean, the first time I saw it, it just felt really vague and, like, unsubstantial. Just an excuse to have cool biker races and, you know, exploding heads.
Yeah, but they're so cool.
No, they are really cool.
They're so good. I think it's my favourite version of a dystopia. Even better than, like, Mad Max 2 and stuff. I mean, if the human race can degenerate so stylishly, then that'd be brilliant.
But I was thinking there as you were talking about Akira, like, I think I saw Akira when I was too old to see it. Like, I saw it when I was maybe, I guess, 18 or something like that. And it always has connotations. Like, a lot of anime has this connotation to me that, like, when I saw it, it was, like, at a pal's house, and he was kind of enamoured with his big cousin, who was like an older guy to us, but I never really had a lot of respect for him because he just seemed like a bit of a waster. But this, you know, it was like just complete fixation with this guy, and the guy would get, you know, hash and all that, and, you know, but to me he never seemed like an admirable person. And anime seems to me to be the interest of people who have too much time and aren't doing anything productive with their lives.
Once again, I'm going to agree with you. We'll come back to this when you come to the broader subject of anime, because I have a whole rant about this and I didn't want to go too far off
you
subject
agree
here.
That,
but
like, you agree that...
I do. It's especially anime series is just like... It's so juvenile. It's just... It's made for autistic people. That person's happy because he's making that noise. You know, it's like you can't actually read people's faces. But to me, if anyone says they're a huge anime fan, I automatically put my foot back. It's like, you are a bit weird.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly judgmental, but it's been proved true too many times. It's like, and talking to them, it's like, you are actually, you know, deeply autistic. You have no idea what the world's going on about you. And I've met people who are so strange, and like, we have this conversation about a few people who have met living in our time in LA, and it's like, we talk about how anime is this damaging thing where you can't actually do things in your life because you watch anime, and we reference this one person who's so weird. It's like, no, you can't reference that person. Why? Because, like, he's too weird. He's outlying data. He's so extreme. He doesn't represent the rest of anime viewers. But the more we talk about it, it's like, that just seems to be the hardcore subset of anime viewers who are just withdrawn from society. And, you know, like, have those, like, will own one of those cushions of anime characters drawn onto it. Like, you're weird. You're very, very weird. And I can't speak to you for too long.
Jack, would you agree that your fondness for Scotland has increased in your time since leaving?
I think it's changed. I wouldn't say it's increased, but it's definitely changed. My relationship with Scotland is that I really haven't spent much time outside of Glasgow, and I'm very biased towards Glasgow, and I'm aware that's not a good thing. It's really not. It's quite ignorant how little time I've spent, you know, in places that aren't Glasgow. It's quite embarrassing.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you say that, because when you were mentioning that Glasgow's a friendly city, it's never an impression. It's probably a city that's friendly to tourists. But if you're from there, like, Glasgow's a pretty cold city. Like, it's a city where people don't tend to look at other people or acknowledge other people.
I think that's bullshit.
Well, I would disagree. Like, that's certainly my experience from it. Because Glasgow's a metropolis. You know, it's a city that's a fully, you know, fledged city. I heard it described as looking like New York, or feeling like New York would have felt 100 years ago. Like, kind of underdeveloped, but still, you know, the beginnings of something. I don't think it ever will become anything like New York, but I think it has that feeling of being on the edge of something, but not quite there. And I do think Glasgow's kind of... I would contrast it to somewhere like, I remember when I went to Dundee for the first time. You guys ever been to Dundee?
Been there once.
A couple of times. Yeah.
I mean, that was mad. Like, the first time I went there, I was visiting a pal, and I was he was at work all day, and I was kind of alone for the day, just wandering about Dundee, and I was looking for the cinema, and I was in the city centre. I was going to catch a film or something, kill a bit of time, and like the first bloke that I asked, where do you know where the cinema is? He said, "Yeah, I know what it is. I'll drive you there." Like, what? And he was like, yeah, jump in, I'll drive you up to the cinema. And I was like, I'm from Glasgow, like, I don't get in the cars with strangers.
I don't want to have sex with you.
Exactly. But I mean, I suppose, and I know from there, that's probably nothing odd. The second person,
did you get in the car?
I didn't.
No, okay.
I politely declined.
I think that was a wise decision.
I really should have, though, because I never found the cinema. But the second person that I asked was a little old lady who said, I'll walk you there. And she walked with me for about half an hour of just, you know, polite conversation.
But you still didn't find the cinema?
Didn't find the cinema. Eventually she got to the point where she said, I have to go this way now, but you know, what you want to do is carry on this road. And no wonder I never found the cinema, because apparently it's, you know, and then you just need to walk along the motorway for a bit. I was like, what? So now I'm half an hour from the city centre, but, you know, no intentions of walking down the motorway for a bit.
I think you've mistaken this, gross manipulation.
It could be like some sort of abusive tourists.
They just wanted, you know, your companionship, and they stole it from you under the guise of friendliness and helpfulness. But
possibly
you didn't get helped at all.
The worst time that it happened, though, this, like, it has obviously positive influences, this out of Glasgow-ness, where Dundee's such a clean city, it's unbelievable. Like, I actually took photographs of the cleanliness of Dundee. Like, I couldn't find litter. It was insane, like, coming from Glasgow, where people just degrade the city because the city's, you know, chewed them up and spat them out, and now they're, you know, it's just a disregard for the city and the way that great cities should be disregarded by the residents that they've destroyed. But Dundee isn't like that. And I was there, we went to, me and a group of my pals went to a nightclub there. I think there's only two nightclubs in Dundee. There's Fat Sam's, which apparently is like the neddier of the two. But we went to Liquid, and Liquid is kind of, I guess, the more studenty of the two. It's not a very big place, but Dundee's a real university city, and it was crammed. Like, I've never been in a busier nightclub. It was torture. Like, I couldn't move. You couldn't get to the bar. You were like, you know,
never been
like
to the Arches,
certain...
have you, Nick?
No, do you know, actually, I've never been to the Arches. Yeah. I've been, but I can't imagine it being any busier than this. But what was most notable is that there were no apologies when you were bumped into, which is something that, you know, from, I was never like, I'm not a nightclub hound, but I've been to enough nightclubs in Glasgow to know that if you bump into someone, you should apologise. Because you don't know who you bumped into. There could be someone who could start a fight, you know, pretty quickly after you've bumped into them. There's never a bumping into incident that doesn't end with an apology from both parties. But in Dundee, that level of underlying fear isn't really there. Like, this underlying notion that the next person you bump into could legitimately hurt you and would be delighted to hurt you. And I felt like that was a kind of unhealthy expression, or like certainly something that is bred into you in Glasgow, that I think is sort of helpful in these situations, but which was torture in Dundee, where nobody seemed to understand that I was possibly capable of, you know, dropping my drink and starting a fight. I mean, I would say that Glasgow is something distinct from other places in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling of Glasgow, it tends to feel a bit less diverse and cosmopolitan than other cities, namely like Edinburgh or Aberdeen. Mm-hmm. It feels like more people in Glasgow are just from Glasgow and stay there. And, you know, in Edinburgh or Aberdeen, there's more movement, there's more reasons for, you know, someone from other countries or other parts of a country to be there. That's just a feeling that I have when I'm, you know, wandering around in Edinburgh or, like, you know, on a bus or something. It's just, it always feels like you get people like visiting Glasgow on holiday, but I never really feel there's, like, you know, a huge population of people that have moved there for, you know, for this industry or for the university. And that's probably a kind of a false perception, but that's how I feel. You know?
I'd agree with you it's not very metropolitan, but I disagree with Nick that it's not friendly. You can go into a bar, and if you want to, if you're just properly against it, you can just start a chat with the guy next to you. And if you're into Fitbot, it's all the easier. And I don't like Fitbot, and I still managed to do it. I've been bored on a Saturday, went into a bar and just had a conversation with a guy about, I don't know, about music and politics, you know? And that's perfectly acceptable. You try doing that in LA, and that's not going to fly. It's really not. Try doing that in London, that's not going to fly, okay? You can do that. You can get in the night bus and have the guy hammered will sit down next to you, and it's perfectly acceptable to have a conversation with a wrecked drunk guy, just as long as he doesn't try and start anything by the end of the conversation. So admittedly, there's a sense of danger that is in Glasgow, especially Saturday night, Socky Hall Street, Jesus God, right?
Yeah, that friendliness can turn very quickly.
Yeah, it can, right? But I grant you, but it's there. You can start a conversation with a stranger, and it's not a thing. It's just a conversation. And I think that's genuine, and I haven't seen that on film talking about Scotland before. So I think that's something worth... I want to stand by that. As far as, like, you know, my view of Scotland changing since I've been there, definitely. Like, the things I always hated about Glasgow have just gotten worse. Like, I don't even want to talk about it. But, yeah, so change for sure. But I wouldn't say it's, you know, become rosier. I mean, I'm ignorant of a lot of things that are going on now. I mean, every time we speak, I ask you what's going on there, you know, because I'm just shut out, especially the political situation. All I get is Facebook updates. I can't read it in Google News. It depresses me because I'm not there to actually have an opinion on it. All I get is, like, hyperbole. So I try and shut myself out from political news and social news and just depend on my friends and what they think and they feel to inform me. So it's just a strange situation to live.
And Scotland is a very political place at the moment, like, and I think that's hard to escape. And that's what makes it difficult for me, for someone who, A, has no particular interest in, you know, patriotism for Scotland, and, you know, B, who has no particular interest in Scotland's political future. It just washes over me, and I'm just left, you know, completely... I seem completely ignorant, but it's not ignorance, it's just a complete disinterest. And I think it's more like, I love Scotland, but there's a difference between loving Scotland and being, you know, proud to be Scottish, or being proud of your country, or being patriotic. Like, I love Scotland the same way I would love any city that I was born into or grew up in, but that doesn't mean that I'm proud of Scotland in any particular way. I don't really know what to be proud of.
I'd say I feel the same way. You talked about walking around Glasgow. Actually, this is a good segue. You talked about walking around Glasgow and just being admiration of it. And, you know, I lived there my whole life, and I still feel the same way. Just like central Glasgow and the West End, the South Side, just anything with a tenement building that's been, you know, that sense of, like, identity architecturally, the way it's structured is phenomenal. And I went to see Under the Skin, and in our last conversation with us, you told me how that was timestamped for Glasgow in 2014. And I enjoyed the film in some ways and loathed it in others. I really didn't like it in others, but the parts I liked about it were the most superficial, and that, and I'm not exaggerating, every single shot from that van, I was confident I could identify the street or tell you one of two streets it was. Every single shot. And, for someone who just, you know, I do miss my home. I miss Glasgow. Not every day, but I get a pang of just, like, I just want to walk out, you know, do a bit of shopping, get a pint, you know, do that sort of stuff and get in the bus home. It was really, really strange to see, be able to, with confidence, shout out not only what street that was, but I've got a mental image of the entire central Glasgow in my head that I could map out for you.
There were times at the cinema where you almost felt like you were looking through the screen into the street.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, you look at some posters that are up and you're like, Doom was here. MF Doom was here. Like, when was this? Or like, can I still make it? You know, but no, it's. I've spoken before about how much I loved the film, and it's beyond obviously the Scottish thing. I think
it is very much so. Yeah,
it's a film that is so up my alley that it doesn't, you know, doesn't even bear discussion. Really, I mean,
I missed my chance to see it, but as soon as it's out on Blu-ray,
Well, but that's like the Under the Skin and a film like Andre Arnold's Red Road. Are films that seem to intentionally, where like the setting of Glasgow could conceivably be an arbitrary decision, but they really aren't. They seem to be piggybacking on this sense of, I guess, a kind of carnality that's right underneath the surface of Glasgow, like of base people behaving appallingly because. Either because of low aspirations or just because it's what the city does to them. Films that, and again, in that sense, they don't necessarily have to be set in Glasgow, but because they're set in Glasgow, they can steal this national sense of appalling thoughts underneath the surface of everyone in the city. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like,
I am, but I'm just trying to imagine if you're thinking this as like, do these guys like where they come from or not? But yeah,
I love where I come from, but I'm not proud of it again. You know, I love that feeling in those films of just appalling motives at every turn. And it's something like, actually, I remember Jorge Grau, I think he's either George or Jorge. I'll go with Jorge because the guy's Spanish. He was making a, I think he's Spanish. He was making a film called Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, and he went to Manchester to film it. And it's a really cool film, but when he got to Manchester, he realised like this isn't the city that I thought it would be. Like this isn't a scary place, and he decided that he wanted to film in Glasgow. When he saw Glasgow, he went, "This is the place that." You know, has to be the setting for my horror film.
It's kind of weird when you're in Manchester because it feels really small. Yeah. It's quite a low level sort of city. All the buildings are just, you know, like two or three stories, you know, shorter than you think, you know, a big city should be. I can see why that would be a bit divisive.
I don't think he ended up shooting in Glasgow, but he definitely wanted Glasgow. Like that was the city, and there is this perceived sense of something nasty in Glasgow that's not really at the surface but is always lingering there. And I think that's something that Bill Douglas teases out quite successfully, when, and it is this sense of how a country and how a city and how a place can just warp the people that are in it into these weird, misshapen monsters.
Yeah, I'm pretty weird. Don't worry, folks, I'm not weird. I live in the West End.
You're normal just posh. But would you agree with that? That that's kind of a vibe that filmmakers can latch onto and do have historically latched onto when trying to generate that feeling in their films?
I don't really see that much in Glasgow. If they don't talk about Scotland on film, they tend to go to the outdoors and use like the outdoors in Scotland as this place where, you know, the unknown will happen, where supernatural things happen. If you're going to see like Glasgow especially, this has become Glasgow on film rather than Scotland on film, but if you see Glasgow, it's usually just the urban nightmare, you know, and I don't think people really ever go out their way to do, you know, talk about the tenement buildings as like something that's desirable now. It's just depicted still something that which was, you know, they were slum buildings and then they became gentrified and, you know, desirable, and I don't think you ever really see that. I mean, I think I know what you're getting into, and there's this gothic vibe to Glasgow. You know, it can be ominous. You know, all that dull lighting, overcast skies, that sort of uniformity to the building with that gothic twinge. You know, like I get that.
I think it's more the people being terrifying quite a lot of the time. Like you mentioned earlier that conversations with people can begin very polite and then suddenly become very scary.
I almost got into a fight in Kelvin Grove Museum carrying a pram up some stairs. You know, that's how quickly like Glasgow can like change on you.
Yeah.
You know, some guy like steps ahead of me while I'm carrying a pram upstairs, asks if I need help. I say, no, I'm fine. and then his girlfriend makes some comment, and all of a sudden this guy's saying, he looks like a dick.
What?
And then I'm like following him up the stairs, like, what the fuck did you just say to me? And I'm in this like face off with a guy standing like on the landing of the stairs in Kelvin Grove Museum, right above the hall with like the animals, the elephants and all that kind of thing. And I'm literally like, I don't even remember what I said to him, but there was a lot of fuck and a lot of cunt in it. And
you're the problem, Martin, in this city.
And it went from like, I'm having a nice day out with my wife and son and mother-in-law, to I'm going to kick the shit out of someone in Kelvin Grove Museum here. And eventually he got kind of pulled away and went up one flight of stairs, and I went the other way up the flight of stairs to where they used to hang like the St. John of the Christ. But yeah, I was like on a cusp of just like, it's like first day of my holiday and stuff, and I'm like, kill this fucking guy. You know, and yeah, I mean, if you're talking about a city where friendliness can turn quickly, so I was like, can I help you? No. Dick. That's my like personal like greatest bugbear with the Film 4 TV channel here, that they finish a film, and as soon as the last frame of the film is gone and the credits start to roll, they squash it all into a corner and they show adverts talking about how much they love film. We really love it, and we show this film no respect. We've shoved it off into a corner. But the other ones that are coming on next, oh, we love them more. Yeah, I hate that.
I kind of like that.
Oh, it's dreadful.
I like it because it gives me permission to turn the film off. Like, see when a film ends, as soon as I see credits, my instinct is get this off right now. but I kind of feel like it's always like an uneasy feeling when the credits start, because it's like they might show something that is part of the film. You know, I get nothing from the credits. Like, people, snobs, will say, you know, you need to sit through the credits and read all the names.
I like to watch the cast, you know. I like to watch the cast. After the cast, I'm done. I'm not going to sit there for like 5 minutes and
to
watch
see who
like
colorized
a list of like, you know, 700 animators, and pretend that, you know, I care one bit about, you know, what they did.
Well, that was rude of me. Apologies, but I do.
No, we're clearly in a middle ground. You know?
Yeah, I do it like
we're better than you, but we're not top tier.
I think that is very true.
Because I resent the Marvel thing. You said it's like your favorite bit.
Yeah,
I fucking hate that. Yeah. That, you know, they're like, you're going to have to sit through acres of information about people who've done like digitizing for special effects. I mean, the scope that these films require for, you know, to actually fit in all the names of people who are relevant to the production, it's ridiculous now.
And the only interesting thing is like when you're watching it and you see like visual effects supervisor and you go, oh, his name's Colin McRae, that's weird. just like an oddity. The rest of it, you're just completely numb watching these words that are completely meaningless to everybody but the person whose name is.
Yeah, it's for their family, but yeah. You know, unless you're married to someone who actually made the film or they're your kid, then just get up and leave. You know?
I wonder if it's the same Philip Schofield who was a stunt coordinator on this film.
I watch credits, and it's the difference between being the GFT and the Cineworld, okay? And I'll definitely watch credits on an art house film.
I think that puts you on an even like worse level than the generic title watching snob. That's dreadful.
I feel
you're just like, you're just trying to like make the people in the GFT think that you're one of them, but really you're not. You just want to be part of the crowd.
That's
weak.
I don't think I've ever sat through a film in the GFT and felt comfortable. Like, I don't think it's a very welcoming environment. It is a very snobbish environment where you would sit down. And everyone wants you to behold how worthy, you know, they think this film is.
If you go to one of the kind of daytime kind of matinee ones, there's no better place to go and watch like an old western, or that kind of thing.
Sure, I think that's fair.
That's really nice, but I get where you're coming from. Yeah,
but I think like for me personally, I know that you guys may disagree with this, but for me, film of all the art forms is the one that is for the masses. It's for That's why I don't have a problem with people eating popcorn during films or slurping juice. I don't think it's an elitist art form. I don't think it should be. So when you see films, it should be a kind of a welcoming experience. It's for people who can't afford or are disinterested in seeing things in the theatre. I think we all got ingratiated into film in that way. Film presented itself to us as kids as something that was, you know, something that would welcome us in, and I don't know. That's it's certainly when I sit in the GFT, I've never felt as if it's the place where I feel at home. And I guess in LA it would be the Arclight, I suppose.
The Arclight is a okay. I do both the highbrow and the lowbrow cinemas in LA for different reasons. But before we do that, to clarify, I sit through the credits of the GFT because I'm embarrassed to get up and go in case someone will top me. So it's more it's even pettier than want to be one of them.
It's disgraceful.
I know. But I do. I mean, I was just talking before we came on air that I go to the drive-in movie theater here to see movies there. Because it's just you can't beat the deal. It's $9, and it's two movies during the summer, and in the winter when the nights are longer, they give you three movies. So they do
Sorry to interrupt, Jack. Is it $9 per car or $9 per person?
Per person, but it's still a steal. I mean, the average cinema ticket here is about $12 to $15 for a movie. Hang on, I'm being shouted at by my wife. How much is it? Well, they did charge us $18. Yeah.
I think it's mean-spirited to charge per person as opposed to per car.
People would definitely take advantage of that in that situation, but...
Yeah, but would there be anyone who would take... I suppose people would pile into one car. No, you're right.
Yeah.
I think it just feels to me like we're charging per pair of eyes that are looking at this screen as opposed to... You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they're on a ferry where they actually have, like, you know, have weight that has to be like, you know, bore, and then, you know, they have to travel somewhere and use, you know, power. I mean, they're just sitting there.
It feels like if you could go into Cine World and say, I would only like one seat, even though there are two of us, we will be sitting on the same seat. That they should be like, well, you know, you're not going to be able to see it. You're like, that's all right.
I don't think you understand how this works. I mean, like, some people do just pull up and watch through the windshield of the car, but most people, and I do mean most, will reverse into the space, unload maybe three or four camping chairs, break out a cooler full of beer and food, and sit there.
Got you.
Which, when I have kids, I'm definitely doing. I'm going to let them run wild, and I'm going to watch a movie. That's fine. We do that, and the sound's terrible. It's coming through your speaker, so it's mono, and it sounds like something you're watching, like a pirated movie. And the screen is painted white, but there's generally like some bird shit on it, so like it's badly screwing it up whenever the projection's kind of off to the right a little bit. So if there's text, you're missing part of that. But it, you know, you're paying like $3 for a movie. What do you want? And it's a new release, so I don't complain, and I really enjoy the atmosphere. It's kind of nice. The Arclight is like the theater to go to. It's everything's really preened. You're asked to not use your cell phone during the like if someone will come out, stand in front of you, and say hi. Tonight's movie is this. The running time is this. I'll remind you that there's no cell phone calls or text messages during the film.
I'm on board with that. That's cool with me.
Sunny World have started doing that.
Popcorn and drinks. That's different. Phones. No. That's not cool.
Yeah.
If someone's sitting there, like, you know, going through their texts on Facebook or something, I'd get the fuck out. You know?
Yeah.
I've got no tolerance for that whatsoever.
They're bad people. I've got one level of tolerance for it. Like, I can't stand if there's a distraction like that. Like, if there's someone on their phone, either talking on their phone or talking to each other or looking at their phone, it ruins the film for me. Like, I will sit there and go, you know, either I'm going to say something to them and then, you know, be thinking about the thing that I said and whether or not they're going to get me later. or I'm not going to say anything and think about the fact that I should be saying something. And that either way, like, the film I'm watching, like, it happened during Life of Pi. I was watching it going, this is the worst.
Oh, you told me this. Tell Martin.
Oh, it was terrible. Like, there was, like, wee dicks down at the front and they were, I guess they were throwing coins, like...
Why did they go to Life of Pi?
I know. I actually sat in front of as well to a group of three teenagers who went in to see Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. And I was like, I mean, it's like that cliche, what did you think? But I do have one level of tolerance where not only do I'm fully on board with these people talking, but I would rather they talk than they don't talk, and that's when there's an enforcer in the cinema, like somebody who is not going to take this shit anymore, and he's decided that he's going to go up to them and say, you better put that fucking phone down or I'm going to, shut the fuck up. That is like better than the film. If that happens, then I'm like, oh, I can't believe my luck. It's like Jeremy Kyle just happened.
I only had to do that twice.
You should have been at the Cineworld when I went to see Redacted, because someone threw like kind of a wee like kind of sugared like kind of jelly sweet, and like he threw it like over from like the back kind of rows, and it landed in like someone's popcorn in front of me, and I was like, well, this is the Glasgow Film Festival, what the fuck are you doing throwing jelly around? I stood up and I turned around and I said that to him, and I just stared at him for a while, and he seemed to decide that it was, you know, it probably wasn't the appropriate, you know, forum for throwing jelly at people.
Yeah.
And you know, he proceeded to not throw any more jelly at people, but it was weird. I was like, the fuck did you come to Redacted for?
Yeah.
To throw jelly?
I've had it the other way around. I went and saw a film called Dear Molly, I think it's called. It was made by the guy who made the Blair Witch, one of the guys who made the Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty empty screen, but like Emma and I were sat, we were sat in a row to ourselves, and there was a couple in front of us, like diagonally opposite me. And I literally, I had no idea that I was bothering this guy. But I kind of just, and if anyone were to know me, in public, I'm very mild-mannered. Like, I would never intentionally encroach on anyone's space, but I kind of adjusted myself, and he sort of just whipped round and goes, do you want to stop fucking kicking my chair? And I was like, I was frozen like a statue, in fear that I was going to get into a fight with this guy. I mean, clearly that's what I should have been feeling, but it was more just like disbelief that something I had done had affected him that much. Mm-hmm. They could whip round and say that to me. It was like, it was really shocking. And you know, I'm not so much anymore, but I was quite into the Christian thing then, so like the whole way through the film I was like torn in this like this moral qualm of like, I need to say something to him, I need to approach him after this film, and I will either scream at him or I will pray for him.
That'd be brilliant. That'd be so great if you had it done at the end of the film. I know we had a bit of an aggressive encounter, but I'm praying for your soul. I just hope that someday you can, you know, come to, you know,
yeah,
an understanding of your place in the world, yeah, and be content with that.
You should just scream at him. You should assume that him that you're going to pray for him.
That would be brutal. I'll pray for your soul!
I actually have a... Sorry to interrupt you, Jack. I've got a slight story about this film.
Did you reanimate a corpse through love, Nick? That's beautiful.
I certainly did not. But I do believe that love is...
Emma's very lively for a zombie.
Well,
charming.
During this story, Emma probably wishes she was dead. So this, I might not keep this story in, because Emma, I think, at one point specifically asked me not to talk about this on the podcast. So I say this with a pinch of salt.
I think we're going to have to bring Jack out of his editing retirement to get the best. It's got to be impartial.
I swear to God, if this is in the show, I've run it past Emma, and she's happy with it. Or at least she
won't leave you.
Yeah, she's still engaged to me.
You just put a house together. That's a lot of leverage.
Exactly. Right. That's true. Yeah. Okay, so the night we went to see Warm Bodies, right? I met Emma in town, and before we went to see the film, it was a lovely night. We went to Yo Sushi, you know, just opposite Princess Square. Mm-hmm. They had like really nice meal. I like that place. There's days you go where it's bad, days you go where it's good, but this day was actually pretty good. Had some nice sake there, and that, so it was a very pleasant evening. We left. We took a stroll up Buchanan Street, went to Cineworld. 2 tickets to Warm Bodies, please. Went in, sat down,
took in the spectacle, enjoyed the show. Actually left, as I say, feeling surprisingly positively about it. I wasn't expecting a great deal. So we left and we walked. Emma was parked in Bath Street, so we went down Sucky Hall Street because she'd heard that a new Tesco had opened. So this is putting in a context, you know, the Tesco that's now there that once was Poundland.
No. Right, okay.
Wow.
But anyway.
Moved up in the world.
Yeah, so she had heard that they have like some regional sections and Emma's family's Irish, so she wanted to check out the Irish section. So she went in, and there it was. There was all the crisps that she grew up with. There was the bread that she grew up with, the chocolate. So, we went to like the checkout part where they've got like all the self-service checkouts. Mm-hmm. And she's like footering about. She's got a £5 note. It won't be accepted. Keeps coming out. Eventually the manager has to get called. And long story short, the story ends with me shitting in an alleyway. Off Sucky Hall Street. Whilst Emma...
You have to fill in the blanks here, Nick. How did it come to you? Was the Irish food that bad that then on the way home it caused a diarrhea?
I've had Tato crisps, they're fine.
That's exactly the ones that she bought. She's footing about with this £5 note and I feel a bead of sweat running down my head. And I realise, I'm going to shit myself, like, right now. Absolutely no idea why, motivated by absolutely nothing. Just suddenly the bowel tenses.
It's happening.
No. And I think, I can't not shit. Like, and this fucking fiver keeps coming out of this machine. And I'm like, right, I need to go, Emma, I need to go now. And then I end up like, you know, that way you're sort of pacing on the spot. And eventually, like, I'm off the mark and I'm running. I don't know where I'm running to. I'm just running to somewhere where I'm not on Sucky Hall Street. And I end up veering off. It's like, do you know where it is? I don't know if it's technically still, it's just up from the Two Fat Ladies, that restaurant in Blythewood Square. There's an alleyway there that is absurdly wide and there's a main road right beside it. But I'm right at the front, crouched behind a bin, with my trousers around my ankles, molten lava coming out my arsehole. And as I'm sitting there behind this bin, I'm looking out, and I can see the cars clear as day, and they can see me. And there's a police van sitting right there with their CCTV camera on top, pointed straight at me. And I was going, oh my God, this is it. I'm going to get fucking lifted as well into the bargain. But either they were just too polite to stop, and they weren't touching me. They just moved on, and then I just got up. Emma was sort of, you know, staring into a shop window going, what am I engaged to? I was actually talking with my mates afterwards at work. I was telling them the story, and they were, I thought it was funny, but they were going, imagine that story was reversed. Like, imagine Emma was in an alleyway shitting. Could you look at her the same way? And then I'm like, I would hope so, but, you know, clearly Emma has to fill up with a lot more than I do from her. But, oh my God, like, the worst feeling, and just indescribable. And it's a funny memory now, but then I was thinking, like, could the police arrest me? Like,
well, I've heard of people getting arrested for urinating in public, but never heard of anyone getting arrested for shitting in public.
I mean, what could they say? Like, you're shitting in public and I'm supposed to go, right, I have a dilemma at this point. Like, do you want me to just stand here and shit myself? Like, is this the attractive option that you're presenting me? Then I need to drive home with Emma having shat myself. I mean, I would have it out with them and they would have to go like, well, no, that doesn't seem like a reasonable option.
Yeah.
And I'd go like, what I've done is...
I think in most scenarios, people just don't want to be involved in that argument, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think it was not an ideal situation, but it's the lesser of two evils, mm-hmm. to go into the alleyway, yeah. where I attempt some form of decency and have a shit. Fair enough. Mm. I might as well have shat in public because there's the alleyway's so wide that, you know, there was no hiding. Like, if anyone had even glanced into the alleyway, they would have seen a grown man having a shit, you know? That See, if that story...
Yeah, but no one wants to see that. So, I mean, it's you think that everyone's going to be paying attention to you, but no one's going to, like, stop and look. I'm walking on. That's not happening.
I think sheer curiosity would cause them to not immediately look away.
Nah, you're wrong.
But no, if this story ends up in the show, it's because Emma's over it. And okay. if this isn't gone, it's because... I value my relationship, you know, with my fiance. So in any event,
there's so many like pubs and restaurants around Blythewood Square, Suckey Hall Street. You can,
well, no, but not in that immediate area, because you walk out of the Tesco, I can cross the road to go to Brunswick or something like that, but then I have to talk to the bouncer, and by the time I've done that, I've shat myself.
Yeah.
So it's really not the only option I had was to get rid of the immediate problem. And then I walked up to the GFT and...
Dealt with the aftermath.
Yeah. Mm. Sorted it. It was grim, and Emma was feeding me... What would you call those things that you eat that stops you from going... Is it anodine? Not anodine. There's, like, pills you take that stop you from having diarrhoea or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
She bought a pack of them, and she
I remember the adverts for them and stuff. It's like, oh, people, you know... Like, oh no, I've got to go to a wedding, but I need a shit.
Exactly. Well, she bought a
pack
of them.
You can approach your day with confidence, because you know you won't just, like, you know, skitter all over the place.
And I was tic-tacking them, like, you wouldn't believe.
I accidentally overdosed on those on holiday and couldn't take a crap for 4 days. It was the grimmest 4 days. It's so hard. I ended up just, like, doing all the things to give you diarrhea, so just drink tons of dark beer to try and flush your system. Well, that's great. I'm glad that warm bodies will forever be tied to that experience, especially Emma. I'm really glad that warm body will be tied to her experience of you almost shitting yourself. That's beautiful. That's
evocative.
Yeah.
I think if you're in an alley, then you still are kind of shitting yourself.
You think so?
Yeah. I don't think you've dealt with this scenario in a modern hygienic manner.
Well, okay, I mean, fair enough. It's a faux pas.
At least you can walk away from it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see that there wasn't a more attractive solution immediately available, and I'm perfectly happy to say that, you know, I did what I thought was best in that situation. It's unfortunate that the police van was sitting there like some kind of, you know, lion staring at a wildebeest who's, you know, feasting on, you know, some...
Or defecating itself, a wildebeest defecating itself, and the lion going, oh, no, you're all right, actually, no, I'll just go to another wildebeest and get that one instead.
You don't want to get into a confrontation with someone in that scenario, you know? They're normal people, pretty much, you know?
Yeah,
they don't want to have to, like, you know, wrestle you to the ground if you get aggressive, you know?
Honestly, if anyone dignified, would that you be?
Like an episode of Oz or something?
Yeah. Trousers around my ankle, shitty arse, handcuffed at the ankles. Oh my god, that'd be terrible.
Okay, Martin, you've got something to say about the Wheelers, I'm sure.
Yeah, because why I ended up watching Return to Oz was that I was in a we were on a wee holiday in a holiday camp. It was, you know, my family, my grandma was there, and
this is as a child, yes.
Yeah, as a small child, like I'm thinking probably 6 or 7 years old, and my grandma and my aunt Pat are going to take me to see, you know, Return to Oz, because, you know, in my grand's mind, you know, The Wizard of Oz is a nice film with bright colours and songs and so on. So they take us along to this, and, you know, in good faith, thinking this will be a nice kid's film, and it scared the shit out of me, because it's about, you know, Oz the place being a, you know, a broken place. It's, you know, it's derelict and sad and creepy, but the thing that stands out, you know, in your memory is the Wheelers, because, you know, they're so unnatural and quick, and they zip past in the background before you actually get a sense of, you know, what's going on. They're just a really ominous threat.
Yeah, they're kind of quadrupeds with wheels for feet.
Yeah, it's very Dr. Seuss. There's a Dr. Seuss film, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, and some of the kind of the stranger characters that inhabit that world, there's some things in Return to Oz it's quite, you know, reminiscent of. And the Wheelers would definitely be at home in the kind of the Dr. Seuss kind of real, you know, real action kind of film. They're just, oh, I don't like them, they give me the shivers. I didn't go back and watch Return to Oz just out of time constraints, but I would be happy to, just to kind of, you know, re-examine what my response now would be to those characters in the setting versus, you know, what my imagination tells me it was, which is something that I really don't want to go back to.
We watched it recently because, like I say, we've watched a lot of kids' films just as a reanalysis of what we'd want to show our children. And if I were to show them Return to Oz, it would be with the intention of traumatising them. That film opens with Dorothy being placed in an asylum to get electroshock therapy because she's insane and they don't believe that Oz exists. So that's how it opens. That's the opening of Return to Oz. And from there, it just gets creepier.
I actually went to a horror film discussion group a couple of months ago, and they were talking about horror that's aimed directly at children, and one of the films they showed was Return to Oz. I don't think I'd remembered that I'd seen it until they actually started showing clips, and I remembered the little clock man, and I remembered the bit where there's like lots of heads on the wall, and she's got to sneak past them or something.
It's this queen who has different heads. And she removes her heads at will and puts them in boxes, and she revives them through this, which is basically like a kind of pixie dust scenario, which Dorothy's trying to steal and ends up using on, I think it's a pumpkin that comes to life and is a sort of scarecrow type character. She sprinkles it on a moose's head, which she then attaches to a basket and puts palm leaves on that can then fly. It's just really creepy and weird. The Goblin King is this, who's the main villain, is this claymation villain who has already overtaken Oz. He's already conquered it, but is defeated through an egg. He eats an egg and he disintegrates. And that in itself sounds really, once again, almost Dr. Seuss-ish, just odd and, you know, innocuous but creepy. But the way the claymation's done and the way that character's portrayed is really effective and just kind of nasty. And it would definitely have an adverse effect on a young psyche. I know it did on mine. I think the reason the Wheelers stuck with you, Martin, is because they're basically Dorothy and Toto are chased down into a doorway and they lock it behind her and they're just beating on the door, telling her to let her in and they'll be back for her.
Mm-hmm.
And they show up with these kind of carnival grotesque clown masks on too, which are then removed to show they're just people, but they're covered in kind of like 1980s punk makeup. So it's just like a reveal of the grotesque to release like what is like, you know, another version of the grotesque underneath that. And there's something really psychologically disturbing about them and weird. But I'm glad it's shown up in discussion groups for horror. That makes me happy. That means it did traumatise kids.
Yeah, it did. And a lot of people seem to be still feeling the effects of it. But, like, a lot of it, like, I don't know if this is, like, widely known or if I'm just saying something kind of trite and hackneyed, but the opening where she's being wheeled in on the gurney, like, she's going to get electroshock therapy or something. But the sound of the wheels that squeak is the sound of the Wheelers that come back later on. Apparently, can tie everything into the opening, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. Whether or not like that's actually spelled out in the film, and I'm just saying it as if I just came up with it, then I have no idea, having not watched the film from beginning to end all the way through.
That adds another, like, you know, angle into, you know, what the viewing experience would have been like for my group, because my gran actually had electroconvulsive therapy.
Oh my god.
No, she did. It was to treat depression.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did it work?
In its way, yeah.
So, your grandmother...
Wow, geez, oh.
Your grandmother sat and watched this movie about this highly controversial treatment being used on an 11-year-old girl with her grandchild to then cause her to go into a fantasy world and like live out a nightmare. I think
you're that must have been a kind of weird day for her.
That must have been a weird ass day for her. Wow.
Sweet. Well, one thing we could do to make it like at least current affairs for us is to describe, like, do you think the things that scared you as kids are the things that scare you nowadays, or do you think you've changed?
I can't think of it. It's going to sound really pompous, but I don't really have anything scares me anymore. I don't really feel any attachment to modern horror. I don't get scared very easily. If I do get scared, it's a very simple jump scare, which I still enjoy, but I'm never really affected by atmospherics that heavily. I don't know if that just sounds jaded or old or overly masculine, but I don't know. How do you feel, Martin?
I think it tends to be less of the jump scare aspect. I feel that that's usually just, you know, a big sound effect and a whoosh, and then you're, you know, you're past it. It tends to be more moods of films, senses of uneasiness, or, you know, something being, you know, fundamentally wrong in a, you know, a fictional world, or, you know, whatever, you know, thing it's trying to depict. But yeah, I mean we spoke about like the found footage horror films, you know, a few weeks past. Begotten has, you know, a powerful, fearful aspect to it for me, because watching it, I was immediately, you know, in a sense of, I'm not sure what this is, and I have no idea what's coming next, and it could be something that really is quite horrible or quite inventively disgusting, and I'm not quite sure if I'm, you know, emotionally set up to receive what it's looking to pass on to me.
There's almost a sense watching it of like, am I allowed to watch this?
Yeah. I mean, I was watching it, you know, on the computer screen, and I felt the need to explain to my wife that it was because it was on a list that I was watching it, you know, because it's like, why are you choosing to watch this, you know, this man, you know, hacking himself to pieces and, you know, defecating and being brought back to life, and, you know, yeah, I felt the need to, you know, explain myself and be like, you know, it was them other boys made me do it.
And then she's like, but why are you masturbating?
He's got this quote that I can't remember what it is. In France, I'm on a tour. In Britain, I'm a genre filmmaker. In America, I'm a bum. I think that's the quote. I'll post it on the Tumblr feed with a link to a documentary I saw about him. But does that not just speak wonders about the kind of the breadth of his reception he's had, and especially his one at home, and what it means for his movies? But if you ask anyone who listens to soundtracks, no one's arguing with John Carpenter. It's like, no, he's right up there. And it's all the more respect that he's the director, the writer, and in a lot of cases, the editor. So, yeah, I've got mad respect for him, even though he's made some total shite in his time. He deserves mad respect. And the score for Escape from New York is awesome, too. Yeah. So, listen, if I start talking about the thing, this is going to last for another hour. I'm going to stay hands off, and it's just know that I will advocate this movie to anyone who likes cinema, and I'll just, Martin, please say something, because I'm going to turn all fanboy on you. You're going to have to start.
Okay. Well, gauntlet thrown down. For me, the standout thing is uncertainty in the group, in the thing. That's my favourite element of it. Is that no one knows who is who, if you're human or if you're alien. No one knows who they can trust because of that. I really like that sense of, you know, discomfort that comes from that, when they all have to kind of, you know, club together to try and defeat this insurmountable enemy, but there's going to be that enemy from within as well. I think that's just a great way to set up a kind of last stand movie. It honestly continues right to the end of the film. I'm not 100% convinced that, you know, Kurt Russell isn't
isn't one of these things. But that's more a kind of, you know, nitpicking plot point. But yeah, it's a movie that I can really unreservedly recommend. I don't recall ever like showing it to anyone or going to see it with anyone and them coming away with, you know, a bad impression of it. It's tense. It looks beautiful. Like the Alaskan cinematography standing in for, you know, the Antarctic. It looks like it's a genuine, like, kind of desolate wasteland. Feels really isolated. It's a believable, you know, place to be cut off from humanity. It's not like, you know, oh no, I lost my phone, and oh, my phone battery's dead too. Well, fuck, now we'll just have to fight this alien ourselves. It really is a, you know, a believable, you know, place to, you know, to face that kind of, you know, discovery in the worst possible circumstances. I would quite happily gush over it for a long time. Yeah. There's not much I can pick at with it, honestly, at all. Its effects stand up, its pacing stands up. There's not a bum note as far as acting goes. The conflict's believable. It's superlative.
I agreed, but I probably have more nitpicks with it than you guys do. And it was funny, you were saying there about the fact that you think Kurt Russell may be an alien at the end. Don't you think They Live feels like it should have been like a Twilight Zone episode where Roddy Piper puts on the glasses, sees Obey, and then goes through some high drinks, tries to shut down the system, eventually looks in a mirror and realises that he too is an alien, and he's been an alien all this time. Isn't that definitely the way that that story should have went, like from a Twilight Zone element aspect, and instead they overstretched it into this film that has one idea, and one idea isn't enough to get it from A to Z. But in any event, with The Thing, historically it's been a film that I've been really impressed with without necessarily feeling any great connection to. There is just, at some level, a sort of disconnect. And I think, genuinely, it might just be a little bit too butch for my delicate palate. I need a little more estrogen in there than the film's actually offering me. I was saying before about the characters being supremely competent in most of John Carpenter's films, and I think this film is no exception. Like, they have a challenge on their hands that is, you know, pretty extreme, and I can't think of anyone who would be up to facing that challenge. But if I had to pick anyone who would be up to this challenge, it would be this group of men. Like, they are the best placed in the world to deal with this particular situation that's unfolding right then and there. I can't help but wish they were slightly less competent.
Most of them are. I mean, you get things the command breaks down and everyone suspects the captain, and they want to nominate Norris to take over, and he's like, no, guys, I ain't up to this.
Yeah. But isn't that a great bit of writing, though? Like, I don't have this in me, I'm sorry. And someone backs down from that role, and you realise at that point, like, oh my God, who's going to lead this?
If I am facing, like, you know, an end-of-the-world scenario where I have to, stand up and be counted and, you know, defeat alien forces, I'm either going to want to be directed by John Carpenter or Howard Hawks to do so, because at least then I know I'll be good at my job, and he's the best of the best. They play it up from the very start when I forget the name of the other helicopter pilot. They're going to send him up, but they're reluctant to. But MacReady can go up.
Exactly.
You know? It'll be fine. Don't worry. He's got the big hat.
The safest pair of hands that you can imagine. And that's just the thing. I mean, these are men that are like stoical professionals who are, you know, clinical and completely you know, the best at their job, so much so that in that first act I find it really problematic that the film isn't really interested in their feelings. It's just because the film's far too butch to be interested in their feelings. It's about their activity and doing their job and seeing this thing through, investigating it. This is our duty in this moment. We need to see this. We need to do an autopsy. Completely, you know, forgetting the fact that, you know, oh my god, that's a fucking alien, and freaking out. It's like, no, we're men here. This is what men do. Get this stripped off. We'll have a look and see, you know, exactly what's going on with this thing. And for me, that was always, there was always kind of a disconnect on that level. The film really isn't interested in any needless embellishments. It's just straightforward from that point. And that always, as I say, left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth. The second act, though, I would argue that that might be necessary, because in the second act of the film, which is incredible, the whole, you know, which one of us is an alien angle of it, they actually take this group of professionals, great at their job, members of a team, their strength in this team, and pull the rug out from under them and say, okay, there is safety and security in your team, but what if the team is undermined? What if one of this team isn't who you think they are?
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly they're faced with a more intimate threat, but one that is so satisfying in that second act that I'd be loath to change the first act, you know, even though the first act isn't necessarily as palatable to me as it is to you guys.
I can understand that feeling, because with discovering, you know, an alien, you know, life form and, you know, a big fucking spaceship, you would think at some point they'd have a moment where they're like, holy shit, can you believe this?
MacReady, I'm shiting myself. Yeah, see if they just said that. But instead, you know, they're very much, you know, men doing their job. I mean, there are characters in the periphery who are, you know, possibly less well equipped to deal with this situation than others, but on the whole, this is a group of men who I'm happy to see dealing with this situation in this moment.
Yeah, no, there's an exceptional level of stoicism, you know, coming out from this group, yeah.
But that second act, man, it's so great. Like, the testing sequence is so well done. Like, the idea of using the hot pin to, you know, stick in the blood and seeing when the blood defends itself, and the effects are so great. There's an incredible sense of horror. See, when they're tied to the bloke that starts thinging out and starts, and they're like, that's
thinging
like,
out. I like that.
Yeah, there's like, that's the probably one of the few moments of genuine terror that these characters express, where they're like, you know, horrified, and no wonder, like, it's horrific to see happen. But even when MacReady starts,
well, that's the one.
Go on, Jack.
I think I'm never sure if I've lost you or not. It's been such a bad signal today that you're dipping out and out, and I'm never sure if I'm interrupting you or you're gone.
Well, no, go on.
Sorry,
you're coming through clear enough now. So,
okay, they're talking about the sequence of the guy. They're all strapped, and then next to the guy who's thinging out, which I love that, by the way. That's the one sequence I could criticise. If you look at it, they're all tied to a couch, which in essence means if they stand up, they'll just take the couch pillows behind them and walk away. That's all it means.
Never
they're individually tied.
There's a metal frame on it, you know.
they're not attached to the frame. That's the one part I'm looking at. It's like, they're screaming, I'm like, I would just stand up and run away. That's what I would do. That's the only part that I
can, I mean, I do believe they have their feet tied as well. You know,
I would manage. They're not tied to one another is the key part.
I haven't subjected it to, you know, quite as much visual scrutiny as you have, so I'd have to check how they're actually attached to it. But yeah, I can see your point. I mean, I think, like, weird plot points. I mean, like, things like, I mean, MacReady's the obvious hero. The one that struck me rewatching it was thinking, okay, Blair, the, you know, the kind of leader, the kind of scientist of the group, he seems to get, it feels like to me, he actually is the one that saves the world.
Mm.
I think Blair saves the world. I think he knows what's happening. He's the one who isolates themselves so they can't be, you know, discovered. He's the one that destroys the helicopter. He's the one that destroys all the communication stuff. And then when he's been, like, cast out because, like, oh, he's crazy, then I think at some point he gets thinged,
yeah,
as you would you know, put it. And then when they go back to him, he's like, "Yeah, I feel a lot better now. I can come back in. I'm fine." And in that period, he's, you know, gone and taken helicopter parts and, you know, made this funky wee spaceship to kind of, you know, escape from. But I think, like, the human Blair, I think he's the one that kind of, you know, that saves everyone. I want to give him credit for that.
No, that's fine. I mean, but if, no, go on, Jack.
You talked about periphery, and I think that's a really important thing about it, is the nagging self-doubt that what you see may or may not be happening. Entire scenes play on that. They play on the aspect of, like, is this person saying that as a human with a genuine fear, or as someone infected that is going to lure someone to a certain place at a certain time? And I think the amount of editing and hammering on dialogue that must have gone into the script to make the ambiguity so palpable. If you get palpable ambiguity, what a terrible combination of words. You get what I mean? Just it's a craft, it's a skill, it's so well written. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the framing of characters next to one another, you know, while dialogue's going on, or in terms of dialogue that's just been said in previous scenes, that the framing for characters and what's happening here is no mistake. It is a director's movie in terms of just someone's framed from the waist up, or in a two shot, or in a three shot, they become the two shot. And it's just complete craft and art. And this is what I warned you about. I'm gushing. I don't have anything to criticize this apart from very nitpicky things that do not inhibit my enjoyment of it. It's a terrific, terrific movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you can lead people down a path of thinking, okay, that guy's a human, that guy's a human, this guy's definitely been turned already, and then undermine that and not have the viewer feel like totally ripped off and like, oh, come on, you're not going to do the split personality thing to me, are you?
Yeah.
I think that it's a great technical feat to keep that kind of uncertainty going without having to resort to, you know, a really cheap twist. It's a really good horror movie that sustains its, you know, uncertainty without any need for, like, a kind of, you know, showy kind of change.
Yeah, I mean, you would say that, and you say that, you know, when it gets to, like, the end of the film, there's some ambiguity in your mind about whether or not MacReady's actually been infected by the alien. I would be more inclined to accept the film on face value and say that he is who he says he is, because that just appeals to my sense of what John Carpenter sees as, like, the traditional masculine hero, someone who's very upfront.
I'd prefer to think that he is, you know, normal. He is still the human.
Yeah.
You know? But you get enough uncertainty with, like, the tattered, like, clothing that they find.
Sure.
And it's, like, the guy Fuchs who finds it, and then he ends up being the next one who's, you know, turned and killed. So it's just a slight little, you know, hitch, and maybe it's not all it seems, but I'd rather think that, you know, it's just, you know, men's men making a last stand kind of thing.
But see, that's just it. Like, for me, that ambiguity only extends as far as the end of Act Two, and when they work out who everyone is, they go back to being the consummate professionals, and they have a plan. They see that plan through, and the plan succeeds, and it's the end of the film, you know? And there's not really an Act Three. The Act Three is, we've got a plan, let's do it. And they do it, and they win, but they have to obviously see out the winter or whatever, and definitely die.
No, I mean, it's a really nihilistic, you know, stop to a film. It's not like a kind of, you know, traditional wrapping up, you know, end for a movie, because it's, well, this is the end of the line for these people.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I like that part in the script. It's like, okay, that's it. There's no escape for us anymore. We have to take this thing out. And the next scene is them throwing Molotov cocktails into a room, moving down a corridor, and it takes time to show you doing three or four rooms, and you realise they're not fucking around. That's it. And it's just so intense. It's like a complete suicide mission. I love the tone of this.
I'm disappointed for you. I genuinely feel a bit sorry for you that, you know, there's something that's just so, you know, emotionally rewarding, and you're just like, yeah, don't like it. Yeah, he's not a good actor. Yeah, don't know. I just, I feel bad for you. You have my sympathy. And I'm sorry, because there's just, I don't know how what ways, in just about any film that I've watched, out of all of them, the character, it's not even a character, there's, you know, a minuscule character that I want to be in just to be part of it. I want to be the guy that throws Rocky an apple when he's running through the streets. I would give my right arm just to, like, you know, have a moment in my life that I felt so perfectly part of, like, an entire community who's all, like, rallied around this one thing, and you just throw a guy an apple and he's just, like, running off to go and become, like, you know, a heavyweight contender. It's beautiful. And for you not to get anything like that from Rocky is, you have my sympathies.
See, this is where I'm maybe split from you a little bit, and you might have to give me your sympathy as well. I don't want you bestowing it completely on Jack.
I'm quite generous.
I don't think the film's that uplifting. Like, that was my impression when I watched it this time, is that I was just completely saturated by the grimness of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, there's a lot of harsh as well.
Yeah, it's so harsh that I don't think it really... Even when I could see the scenes that I know are famous for being stirring, like his, you know, running through the streets, it didn't seem anything but, you know, desperate and grim and, you know, inevitably bad for when he ultimately has to face up to this unbelievable challenge that he set himself. I think the cumulative effect of all the grimness of the film doesn't really get washed away by the emotional uplift. I don't think it has to either. Like, I think the film's great, but I think it's so cynical as it progresses that it's hard to, you know, it's hard to think of it as an uplifting sports movie rather than just this seedy urban drama. You know, I mentioned earlier about Polly. Polly's an arsehole at the beginning of the film, and he's an arsehole at the end of the film.
And he's an arsehole in, like, you know, Rocky Balboa.
I mean, he gets some redemption.
He's an arsehole for decades.
He gets some redemption. You
yeah,
know,
but he always claws it back to remind you that he's still just a fucking self-interested arse.
Yeah. And Mickey's an arsehole as well. Mm. You know, he isn't a good guy. He kicks Stallone when he's down and comes back when it seems like there's some kind of attempt at him to recapture some sort of former glory, and he's pathetic and he's grovelling, and he ends up knowing that he's banged to rights walking away, and it's the, you know, Rocky's good heart that leads him out to meet with Mickey and go, I know you're a bastard, but, you know, I can bring you with me and we can maybe, you know, find some kind of peace with each other. But I don't think that character undergoes a massive change. And I think that's indicative of this feeling of realism throughout the whole film. It doesn't see the need to redeem characters where you would expect it to. Even, like, even down to... Oh, what's the guy's name? He was in Maniac. Is it Joe Spinell or Spinelli? He plays the pimp in the film, I think.
Oh, the loan shark?
The mafia guy.
Yeah, he's not a pimp. He's dressed like a pimp.
He's a loan shark.
He is good to Rocky, and you expect that to come back and, you know...
Yeah, but instead he's just generous.
Yeah. And it's this feeling that sometimes people are good, sometimes people are bad, and there's no way to really get a handle on it. And, you know, there's nothing you can do but just try and claw something back out of this world that is suffocating and stifling, and people won't change. You know, it's so oppressive, so much so that when you cut to, like, Apollo Creed and what he's doing, you're suddenly aware that you've been so locked into this world that when these people start talking sensibly about things, it feels like you're on another planet, you know? They're talking with logic, and they're removed from all this, you know, the stink of the streets, and you know, you're going to have to go back and be trapped there for a little while longer. Mm-hmm. But while you're with Apollo, you know, you're like, wow, there are sensible people in this world. You know, how the hell is Rocky going to match up to this?
Yeah, it's you know, him against a kind of marketing machine.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, it's absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. Go on.
No, it's okay, go ahead.
No, I've been talking too long.
Well, you were talking about realism, and I'm just watching it think, wow, this film really wants to be realistic. It's trying really hard to be realistic. And it just came across as like,
hyperbole and like really broad strokes, and I didn't really buy it. It's not the kind of quiet realism that you might expect from.
It's not like a Mike Lee film. I mean, it's a sports drama. You know, I mean, you have to adjust expectations for the genre sometimes.
Well, I just don't think the genre of realism and sports drama and this type of sports drama really marry up. I thought it was a real contradiction, and it just stopped me from enjoying it. I kind of wanted it to be
contradiction.
Yeah.
Harsh underdog makes good. Ugh.
How is that realism? I wanted it to be more melodramatic and more over the top, or pare it back.
That's why you have Rocky 3. If you want more melodrama, you go to 3 and 4.
This is what I'm talking about, is like I enjoyed those movies for their high melodrama. And
I mean, the reason I asked was just because I think his relationship with Adrian is so lovely in the film. You know, it's these two misfits who are just perfect for each other, you know, that really can give each other what they need in that particular moment. And it's not as if he's some kind of arsehole boxer who's chasing, you know, a dolly bird on each arm. He's going after, you know, his friend's mousy sister. And, you know, you think about the scenes that they're in, and Bill Conti's score is so lovely when they're, you know, when Stallone finally gets a chance to take her out and they go into the derelict, or it's not really derelict, it's just closed.
It's closed for July 4th, yeah. For Thanksgiving, yeah. No, that was a cute scene. The whole time was like...
But there's actually a dark side, see, because I think the film does a good job of setting this really grim tone that you find it hard to really breathe in. When he takes her back to his apartment and he like takes off his top and he's got his wife beater on and he puts the music on, you think he might rape her. you really can't tell which way it's going to go, because I think you know it basically that Stallone's a good guy, but you know, you think she wants to go, he doesn't want her to go, but he doesn't really have any way of expressing himself beyond, you know, what he's done so far. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's very much a kind of an ill-fitting cog where you just can't really judge his next step. And I think it always keeps you on edge, and I think that scene is very good, and for that reason.
Yeah, no, it's a very awkward scene in the best way, because it's like, you know, it's people being romantic but not quite knowing how to be romantic. They don't know how to kiss. They all kind of like awkwardly kind of like slouch down to the floor, like kind of sliding down. It's just, it's all weird and like, you know, wonky positioning and stuff.
And that character wouldn't be in a Rocky remake that was now. I mean, you'd have an Adrian, but she wouldn't be, you know, a mousy sister. She would be like a high school sweetheart who was, you know, clearly absolutely gorgeous, but, you know, is a housewife now. You know, I don't think they would take the risk of making her quite as clearly ill-fitting as Talia Shire is.
Well, I mean, they might not do, you know, the kind of same kind of, you know, sort of costuming and, you know, absence of makeup, but I mean, Talia Shire is beautiful.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, she's lovely.
The Godfather and so on. I mean, she shines in it when they actually, like, you know, get her out of the kind of, you know, umpteen layers of frump that they pile on. But
she's one of the sisters, isn't she, in The Godfather? She's the one that Sonny, she's been up by her husband, and Sonny goes and batters him,
mm-hmm.
and she's kind of shrieking, and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it shows how restrained her performance is in this film, and how well she's able to convey that sort of, you know, untouched sort of quality. It's not even a purity. It's like a kind of, it's hard to describe. It's just a clenched fist quality, where it feels like Rocky could be good at bringing her out of her shell. You know, it doesn't feel as if she's some kind of saint. It just feels as if she doesn't know how to act in the same way that he doesn't know how to act.
But no, I thought the scene with them having like their first kiss, it's one of the most awkward, like, you know, people about to have sex scenes ever. I don't want to watch these people have sex. It's going to be all like lumpy and awkward, and they won't know what to do. It's totally un-Hollywood.
And Stallone would probably destroy her.
That's a horrible thought to end that with, isn't it?
Oh well, I guess that's the party winding down for this evening. We've had a lovely time. It's been a lot of fun. I suppose all that's left for us to do is just to say our goodbyes. We'd like to say a massive thank you to our partners, Lauren, Kiyomi and Emma, for their support and patience and understanding through what has been, you know, a very busy year for all of us. They've just been fantastic. And obviously a massive thank you goes to you, the listener. We'll have plenty more content for you in the new year. So I wish you all a very happy new year and have a Merry Christmas. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Ede. Nice handle, Nick.